Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
no end in sight to Israeli crimes. Regime forces have shot another Palestinian youth near occupied Al-Quds over an alleged stabbing attack. Ahead of the UN General Assembly's annual meeting, President Raisi says interaction with world countries and international organizations is a pillar of Iran's policy. Also in the headlines, U.S.'s main auto workers union warns an ongoing strike at the top three car makers will expand if no agreement on pay hikes is reached.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
Israeli forces have shot yet another young Palestinian man in the occupied territories. The regime troopers shot the man at a checkpoint near occupied Al-Quds for allegedly attempting to carry out a stabbing attack. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, was with us and gave us the details.
Now, the Israeli military issued a statement saying that a Palestinian, or a suspect, they said first, approached the checkpoint of Mazmouria, South Al-Quds, crossing from Sur Bahir village in Al-Quds, and that he had a knife with him. One of the Israeli forces there saw this man wielding a knife. He immediately opened fire directly at this Palestinian man, who was later identified as Palestinian, and they said they neutralized him. When the Israeli military say that they neutralized someone, then this means they used their guns to shoot and kill. They opened fire and killed the Palestinian. However, Palestinian Ministry of Health, up till the moment, didn't inform, had not been informed directly from the Israeli authorities that a Palestinian was shot and killed, or who is this Palestinian. They didn't reveal his identity. We are speaking about news and reports coming from the Israeli military. A Palestinian man had been neutralized. First, they said that he was shot and he was in serious condition. Then they said that he was neutralized.
Israeli forces have once again attacked protesters across the Gaza Strip, injuring at least six, including three journalists. A number of Palestinians were wounded in the east of Rafah governorate along the border fence with Israel as regime forces targeted protesters with live fire and tear gas. Three Palestinian journalists were also injured by Israeli tear gas during a protest east of the town of Jabalia. The Palestinians were protesting against ongoing Israeli aggression, including attacks on Muslim worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. Israel also recently launched airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, which it claimed targeted the positions of Hamas resistance movement. Thousands of Israelis have once again hit the streets of Tel Aviv to protest against the far-right cabinet's contentious judicial overhaul. The demonstrators chanted slogans against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the 37th weekly protest. There were similar rallies in other cities. One of them took place outside of an airport from where Netanyahu was departing for the U.S. The cabinet led by Netanyahu passed the judicial changes in an unprecedented showdown that pit the judiciary against executive and legislator. Mass rallies have been ongoing since the cabinet presented the bill to the Knesset to strip the High Court out of much of its powers. Critics say the legislation removes vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. The Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip has been taking a huge toll on the local population since 2007. Gaza health officials say that hundreds of patients suffering from chronic kidney diseases are now at grave risk due to the blockade, with hospitals running short on medicine and supplies. Ashraf Shannon brings us more details from Gaza.
The health ministry in Gaza Strip says that the lives of hundreds of kidney failure patients are at risk due to lack of medicine and special chemicals needed for dialysis machines. Most kidney patients are hospitalized in the territory's biggest medical center, the Shifa Hospital. The hospital, just like other health facilities in Gaza, has been struggling with severe shortage of basic supplies for several years under the Israeli blockade. This has hit the patients with chronic diseases, including renal failure, the hardest, and children are no exception.
Kidney failure patients in Gaza Strip are amounting to 1,100. These patients, usually every one of them will make dialysis 3 times per week in different hospitals of Gaza Strip. Among those 1,100, we have 38 children. So without having those dialysis every week 3 times, they will certainly succumb to their life and they will die.
The lives of kidney failure patients depend on dialysis machines, but they usually malfunction due to overuse and lack of spare parts for repairs.
I need kidney dialysis 3 times a week, and I suffer from various illnesses. Dozens of medicines are nowhere to be found in Gaza's hospitals. The situation is very dangerous, and not having the treatment is a death sentence to kidney patients.
Death and suffering for Palestinians have always been what has come out of Israel's policy of keeping almost every necessity under scarcity in the Gaza Strip. And the health system has been no exception.
Today, this crisis is very acute now. I think this is the top urgent crisis we're facing in Gaza Strip today. And as you know, every now and then, the Israelis are still waving to attack Gaza once again. So the situation is very hard, complicated. And humanitarian issues, including health sector, should be avoided from all those punishment to the Palestinian people, because the patients will pay their lives.
What makes things worse for Palestinians is the fact that the international community remain apathetic to their plight.
Gazans have been facing difficulties in receiving medical care since 2007. The Ministry of Health blames the Israeli blockade for the endless suffering, especially among chronically ill patients. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has departed for New York to attend the 78th session of the UN General Assembly. Addressing reporters ahead of his departure, Raisi underlined that his administration favors a world free from injustice and discrimination. He said that he will use the opportunity to be the voice of all Iranians. Raisi stressed that interaction with world countries, as well as regional, extra-regional, and international organizations, is a pillar of Iran's policy. He said meeting with several heads of state in order to enhance bilateral relations is on the agenda during his trip to New York. The Iranian president is scheduled to address the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. Pakistan's economic experts and the business community have called on the government to boost energy trade with Iran so the country can overcome its ongoing energy crisis. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan has been facing an acute energy crisis for many years. To overcome the energy needs of the country, a national energy conference was organized in Islamabad to explore ways to handle the energy supply deficiency. The conference was attended by energy experts, economists, traders, and political activists. The business community expressed its serious concerns over growing energy deficit in the country, demanding the government to defy the U.S. requests and move to import cheaper electricity and gas supplies from neighboring countries, especially Iran.
We have an abundant resource of energy next door, but due to international political pressures, we are unable to tap that resource, which will be good for our economy plus the economy of our neighbor.
Analysts say the energy crisis poses serious threats to Pakistan's fragile economy and national security environment, urging the government to further strengthen economic ties with Tehran.
Yes, the option is very nice. And we have no other chance other than to connect our all gas-fired power plant with the Iranian gas pipeline. And that is already terminated at the border.
Allah has blessed us with the abundant renewable resources. And if we decide that, okay, we have to go for it, okay, like our neighbors are doing it, okay, in only 5 years, okay, we can go for 100% renewable energy. It's not a big deal.
Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador to Pakistan reiterated that Tehran is ready to help Islamabad meet its energy needs. He said closer energy partnership between the two countries can strengthen their bilateral relations and promote regional stability.
We know that the Pakistani people are in dire need of energy, and we are ready to provide cheaper gas supplies to Pakistan.
Political activists say Pakistan's decision to import cheaper energy supplies from neighboring Iran would offer a promising avenue towards greater economic growth, energy security, and environmental sustainability.
Expanding energy trade with Iran will not only foster economic and diplomatic ties between Islamabad and Tehran, but will also help Pakistan to modernize its infrastructure and harness its energy potential more effectively. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
The leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has finally wrapped up his visit to Russia. Kim Jong-un was gifted a series of Russian drones at the end of his trip. Five explosive drones, a reconnaissance drone, and a bulletproof vest were gifted to the DPRK leader by Russian officials. During his six-day trip, Kim met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, and other high-ranking officials. Kim also inspected state-of-the-art weapons, including a hypersonic missile system, during his stay in Russia. The DPRK leader also inspected some of Russia's nuclear bombers at an airfield before boarding a warship. Moscow has pledged to improve defense cooperation with Pyongyang. The Russian president has also accepted an invitation to visit the DPRK soon. In the U.S., the main auto workers union has warned that a historic strike at the top three car manufacturers will expand if the companies do not agree on pay hikes and other labor issues.
We are now, and if we don't get better offers and we don't get down and take care of the members' needs, then we're going to amp this thing up even more. The reason we're in this situation right now is because all three of the big three companies chose to wait. They chose not to negotiate for the 8 weeks we had. We started this back in July. And we told them then, don't wait till the last minute or you're going to find yourself in a bad position. And unfortunately, they chose to wait till the last week to get down and start talking, to get serious about this, and that's where we are now.
Fain added that members of the United Auto Workers are fed up with falling behind at a time when car manufacturers have been making a fortune. Thousands of auto workers walked off their jobs after their union failed to reach deals with the companies over a new labor contract. The union announced the strike at three assembly plants owned by General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis. They're known as the Detroit Three, and it's the first time in their history that they are hit by a strike. Automakers had offered a 20% pay rise over 4.5 years, which were less than half of the amount that the union had sought. The U.S. has acknowledged that the goal of ousting Russian forces from Ukraine faces, quote, a very high bar. Claims that Kiev has not failed in its counteroffensive. The remarks came from General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff. He said while Ukraine's counterattack was slower than anticipated, it has been steady. He added that Kiev has a lot of combat power remaining. However, he noted that the overall strategy of completely driving out Russian troops from Ukraine would be a very significant effort. The top general also defended U.S. weapons assistance and other aid being sent to Kiev. He said Washington is doing its best and cannot just boost Ukraine's battlefield power by sprinkling what he called magic dust. UNESCO has added another site from Iran to its World Heritage List. The Persian Caravansaray is now officially the country's 27th cultural heritage item to be registered. It consists of a collective property of 54 centuries-old roadside inns located in 24 provinces across Iran. The UNESCO World Heritage Committee says that they are the most influential and valuable examples of caravansarays of Iran. The designation was approved during the 45th session of the committee held in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Caravansarays provide shelter, food, and water for caravans, pilgrims, and other travelers. The routes and the locations were determined by the presence of water, geographical conditions, and security concerns. Iranian athletes will soon be off to China to take part in the 19th Asian Games in Hangzhou. The country usually sits somewhere in the top 10 rows in the number of medals earned, but this year, all eyes are on the female athletes taking part in the event. Gisumi Shahmadi tells us more.
From breaking world records to bringing home gold medals for the first time.
Scream of elation for the Iranian nation. Nahid Kiani, world champion.
Iranian female athletes have been making their mark in the world, from team sports such as futsal and hockey to fencing and canoeing, For these young ladies, sky is the limit.
Over the past 2 years, the administration has worked hard to promote women's sports. That is why our sportswomen have been able to win over 1,300 medals in international tournaments, outnumbering the number of medals earned by male athletes.
Today, the number of female athletes in Iran is greater than that of males in the top 13 sports disciplines, including martial arts, particularly taekwondo, and also track and field, with a number of trailblazers making it possible for a new generation of Muslim girls to join in.
The presence of Iranian female athletes is not just significant in terms of their capabilities. More important than that is their presence on an international level promoting Islamic values. These young ladies are trailblazers that lead the way for sportswomen from other Muslim countries to take part in international events.
Words that were echoed by Iran's president in a meeting with athletes that will soon be off to Hangzhou, China, to take part in the 19th Asian Games.
I always emphasize that we should pay special attention to sports for all members of our society, particularly women. These young ladies are cultural ambassadors that demonstrate to the whole world that our values don't contradict a strong presence in sports events.
Over the past 2 years only, Iranian female athletes have been able to win more than 1,380 colorful medals in different fields, collecting bronze, silver, and gold medals and making Iranians proud.
And now with this amazing record, Iranian women athletes are off to China to make history in the Asian Games. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the International Congress of Persian Poetry and Literature. The National Day of Persian Poetry and Literature is observed across Iran on 18th of September each year, a day named after Iranian poet Shahriar. Shahriar, the legendary Iranian poet, was born in 1907 in the city of Tabriz and died in 1988 in Tehran, at the age of 81.
I'm in the city of Tabriz, where I have attended the Congress on Persian Poetry and Literature. And just after this session, I'm going to visit the Maqbarat al-Shu'ara of Tabriz, where the tomb of Shahryar and many other Iranian poets and notables are located.
He's been described as one of the forerunners in the development of poetry.
The monument of Maqbarat al-Shu'ara is one of the cultural symbols of the city of Tabriz in East Azerbaijan province, northwestern Iran. Maqbarat al-Shu'ara literally means the tomb of poets. This cemetery has housed more than 400 poets, mystics, and writers since 800 years ago. This graveyard has placed the tomb of the famous Iranian poet Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Behjat Tabrizi, known by his pen name Shahryar. According to experts, this graveyard is a rich collection of the history of Iranian literature. Maqbarat al-Shu'ara is a structure with both modern and traditional architectural art, and it creates a sense of connection between the viewer and the design. Here I'm walking on Aref Street of Tabriz, which leads to Maqbarat al-Shu'ara. Tabriz is a beautiful city with amazing weather at this time of the year. Here I can see it. Yes, here's our destination, the Maqbarat al-Shu'ara of Tabriz. When you go up the stairs, you will encounter a huge structure that is actually a great piece of art. Marvelous. It surrounds you with many arches. And to reach the entrance, you must go down the stairs and enter the main space below the symbol of the tomb. When you reach the main section, you will find yourself in a large room with a few smaller rooms next to it. Oh, look at the tomb on the corner. It's fenced with glass with engraved poems on it. This is the grave of Shahryar.
در انتظار تو چشمم سپید گشت و غمی نیست اگر قبول تو افتد فدای چشم سیاهت ز گرد راه برون آب که پیر دست به دیوار به عشق آه یتیمون دویده بر سر راهت بیا که جز تو سزاوار این کلاه و کمر نیست تویی که سود کمربند کهکشان به کلاهت
ای
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, believes that Shahriyar was a prominent poet and his verses showed his wisdom. In the leader's view, although Shahriyar's poems were at a high level in terms of Persian literary standards, they were understandable even to the ordinary people. Shahriyar's poems about the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, clearly indicate his love and devotion. علی ای همای رحمت، تو چه آیتی خدا را که به ما سوا فکندی همه سایه هما را. O Ali, the bird of bliss, what a portent of God thou art, for thy shadow hast overshadowed one and all. دل اگر خدا شناسی همه در رخ علی بین، به علی شناختم من به خدا قسم خدا را. O heart, if thou art Gnostic, seek everything in Ali's image. By God, I came to know God by the very Ali indeed. This room is filled with poetry, writings, sculptures, and paintings of various poets buried here. There are several side sections here as well. One of them is for office work, and another one for selling books, handicrafts, small sculptures, etc. In other sections, you can get to know more about other poets. As they say, art is long, but life is short. And actually, words fail me in speaking about Shahriyar. Shahriyar was the first Iranian poet to compose significant works in Azeri language. His most famous Azeri language poem, Hey Dar Baba, has so far been translated into 90 languages. Shahriyar is one of the shining stars of Iran, which serve as the abstract of Islamic and Iranian insight, as well as a bridge between yesterday and today's poetry.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at the news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. France has sparked outrage across the Muslim world after introducing an abaya ban for all students. The abaya is an important dress item for Muslim women, a key part of implementing modesty and protecting their honour. However, French authorities believe it is somehow contrary to the state's secular values. This is far from the first time French authorities have targeted Muslim females and their clothing, but activists fear the Islamophobic policymaking won't stop with the abaya.
Take it off or go home. That is the choice many female Muslim students had to make when entering school in France. After the French authorities introduced a new ban on a popular loose-fitting clothing item worn by Muslim women known as abaya. The controversial move has received huge condemnation from across the Muslim world and is seen as the latest act of aggression by an Islamophobic regime in Paris, which pushes a strict interpretation of radical secularism onto religious minorities.
The abaya has no place in our schools, no more than any other religious symbols. At the heart of this is conforming to our principles of secularism and neutrality.
The abaya is a simple, loose overgarment, essentially a robe-like dress worn by Muslim women. Traditional abayas are usually black and may either be a large square of fabric draped from the shoulders or head or a long kaftan. The concept of hijab in Islam is compulsory, but it isn't just about covering the hair, but also a woman's body and natural curves. The abaya is a popular way to ensure the concept of hijab is observed by women. On the first day of school following the ban, some 300 women defied it, with onlooking French teachers demanding they undress from the robe or go home. Many chose to leave instead. Amid public outrage and a growing protest movement, French President Macron defended the ban.
Schools in our country are secular, free and compulsory, but foremost secular, and religious signs, whatever they are, do not have a place.
Some have called the ban oppressive, others hypocritical, especially when France has a long history of trying to force its values under the Muslim world, a policy which spans hundreds of years of French imperialism.
Well, joining us today to talk about the oppression of Muslims in France, we have two esteemed guests. Issa Ali is a freelance journalist who worked with RT as their correspondent for 7 years. His specialism is West Asian affairs. And joining us on Skype is Sister Ibtihel, a humanitarian, climate and youth activist in France who has felt the effects of the discriminatory policies against Muslim women. Welcome to you both. Now, before I come to you, Issa, I want to speak to you, Sister Ibtihel, in France. Just tell us about some of those negative effects that you faced as a result of the Islamophobic policymaking that's become very commonplace in France now.
Well, while many children were getting ready to go back to school, we were kind of shocked, but not surprised, with this new abaya ban in schools that was announced by the new education minister. Unfortunately, yeah, France has a long history of exerting domination through control of bodies, and it has happened in the past, in 2004, with the hijab ban in school, and then the niqab ban in the public spaces in 2010, followed by the burkini in some municipalities in 2016. A few years ago, we're speaking about the long skirt and now this new abaya ban that is following the same pattern. So it's been around 20 years now, we have a constant pressure on Muslim women to police their bodies and tell us what we should wear and how we should wear it.
And perhaps you could just tell us, for example, if there are any non-Muslims watching, what is the abaya exactly? Why is it important for Muslims, and how does it fit in with the concept of hijab in general?
Yes, so first of all, the abaya is not a religious garment. It is a cultural outfit, as reminded several times by many leaders of the Muslim community. Overall, this controversy has exposed the double standards that racialized students are subjected to. How do we define the abaya? How do we differentiate it with the long dress, with the black dress, with the another color dress, with the long skirt, except by linking it to the race or alleged religion of the student? And on the ground, the student being harassed could be wearing just a dress or just a skirt or just a coat. As long as they are perceived as Muslim and wearing modest clothes, they are a victim of this harassment campaign.
Well, Issa Ali, let me bring you in now, because you know a little bit of what the French have been up to for quite some time now, especially in its treatment of Muslim minorities. Just tell me why you think that at this stage the French authorities are deciding that the abaya is the next thing that needs to be targeted here. What's the real issue here? They say it's about protecting their secular identity, but is that actually the case?
Well, France has a long history, of course, of hostility to Muslims, and you mentioned it there in your introduction. You know, going back to colonialism, the centuries-long colonialism that France has practiced in Africa in general, but also specifically on Muslim communities in that part of the world, imposing their beliefs, imposing their language, imposing their currency. Still to this day, there are dozens of at least a dozen French countries that are still using the franc currency, which France itself isn't using anymore. There are, you know, countries like Tunisia and other places where that hostility towards Islam and towards Islamic dress is still implemented, even though it's a Muslim country. So this can be, you know, traced back to that colonial need to undress women, in particular undress Muslim women, because, you know, the gaze of the colonialists needs to be upon everything. And they somehow feel threatened because, of course, they are not, you know, we're not talking about in general French people, but of course the colonialists and the people who are behind these policies, they seem to have a very sick and perverted vision of women and their ownership over them, because it's ironic, right? They say that, oh, Muslim men are, you know, protective over their women, or they are, you know, possessive. But it's exactly the same thing, even worse, actually, because you're seeking to take away that female sense of autonomy over themselves. And so that's the first step of this. This is just the latest line in a long history of French aggression towards women, towards Muslims, towards Muslim women in particular. And it also speaks to an insecurity in France as well. If we look on the geopolitical level, we're seeing a number of African countries liberating themselves, kicking out their dictators or their puppet leaders, and installing governments that are outwardly and openly anti-French. They're demanding the French leave their region. Some of those countries are Muslim African countries. And so perhaps this is some type of, you know, very weak attempt to push back against that. But one thing that we've seen, you know, every action has a reaction. And in France, the one thing that always impresses is that the French community, the Muslim French community, always seems to be very strong and outspoken. So even despite all the pressure that's on them, they're always the ones who are at the forefront of that. It would be good for Macron, the former Rothschild banker, to remind himself that his population contains many millions of Muslims and Africans. And if he wants to push too far, there will be a backlash, like the types we've seen over the last 12 months, the huge pro-democracy protests, the huge anti-Macron protests that we've been seeing. So something for him to keep in mind as well.
Absolutely. And sister, let me come back to you. Obviously, you're living there in France now. You know what the situation is like on the ground. Issa said something about, you know, it's not necessarily all French people that support these types of policies. It's about perhaps some, you know, post-colonialist right-wing elements in the government. But what I want to ask you is that, you know, people are electing those policymakers in France. Is this a case where the wider French public seems to have issues, deep-rooted issues with Islamophobia, or is it just a few bad apples in government that are pushing through these policies that are not necessarily so popular?
I think it's more the state in itself and the institutions that are Islamophobic. following with the media that is controlled as well by the state. And because of all that, everything that is shown on media and the ignorance leads to fear and leads to hatred, maybe. But traveling a lot in France and meeting a lot of French people, I haven't felt that much Islamophobia. It's more about intolerance due to ignorance.
Sure. Well, to bring another angle to this discussion, earlier this week we have spoken to a human rights activist, Idriss Sihamedi, who now resides in the UK, but he was forced to flee France due to his fears for his safety amid a police crackdown on his former charity organisation there, Baraka City. He tells us from his experience how hostile the French regime has become to its Muslim minority now.
Because they tried by the veil, the hijab, they did it with the burkini. They did it with, before that, with the niqab, they did it with the forbidden the school for Muslims at home. They did it. So now they thought, okay, what we can do now? There are abaya? Yes. Yes, I will do. And they will have another thing. It was a problem in 2011 when a Muslim community at the moment has been selfish. They thought a problem that the niqab problem was only for just minority Muslima. And finally they said, it's not our problem, it's not our issue, so what we'll do, we will continue to live, etc. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decided that we have together the same problem. Why? Inshallah ta'ala, to be united, to be better, inshallah. Because they didn't find another thing. Now Muslims are very so shameful just to talk about the values or the Quran or something like that. When Muslims are welcome on the TV show, it's only to ask them if they condemn, not what ISIS did. That was 7 years ago, but what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in the Quran. You know the difference? So it's very, very, very dangerous and a new stage, new page opened by Emmanuel Macron, and Muslims should be very clear with their religion, to be very clear. We don't negotiate anything about our religion. Could be the veil, could be the hijab, could be the bird, could be the hijab, could be everything. What Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decided in the Quran, we don't negotiate. And I'm very surprised that the Jewish community, they can say that, and Muslims community are very weak and very shy to say that. It's a big problem, and we have to think about what we did and why the situation never changed. Because even to defend Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in France, when they mocked Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in a building, it was not we were not too engaged. We said it's a freedom and we have to accept, etc. Normally the Muslims said, this is, we'll never ever accept that. To be united is very important. But to be united on what? To be united on Islam. To be united on our on values. Why? Because these people, the racist people, the far right, are saying that we have to be proud of our values. So why Muslims should not be proud of their values? So we have to think and to change our mind. And I think this is also the reason why the society, the French society, changed. It's because the media mainstream, the French media mainstream, worked on that. And the mentality of the society now changed completely. So I think this is the important, to be united on Islam, on the values of Islam, and to don't have any compromise.
Well, there you have it, another opinion from France, a French Algerian who's had a very hard time there. Sister Ibtihel, let me come to you once again, because I want to ask you again, you know, for Muslims living outside of France, it appears as if the French authorities are basically fighting a war against Islam. That's what it looks like. It looks like some kind of petty crusade by a wannabe pound shop Napoleon, who basically wishes to re-establish the French empire over the Muslim world again. That's what it looks like to us. What is it that you guys need from the Muslim world? Is the Muslim world doing enough to help you? What's the effective strategy here? Because it looks only like it's going to get worse for you guys, not better. What do you need from us?
Indeed, this ban and other bans, if enforced, will not be the first of its kind, and it will only confirm the pattern of the institutional Islamophobic and racist measures that the government established through the years to further marginalize and alienate the Muslim community. And this, by this Islamophobic intentions, its racial profiling methodology, we suffer from a lot of harassment. And just defining Islamophobia, which is not yet defined in the definition in the public sphere, is very important. What is Islamophobia? It's being a discrimination or a violence against individuals or structures that are identified as Muslims or perceived as such. And this Habaya ban falls into it. And we don't know what's going to be next, and it might continue. So it is important that the international community is speaking about it, raising awareness about it, supporting the French activists on the ground, and stay to support them, basically.
For sure. Issa, I'm going to ask you about this question as well, in your opinion. You know, the people have been talking about a boycott campaign against French goods. The sister mentioned about pushing through a definition of Islamophobia. Some are even arguing about Hijra. They're arguing about the concept of Hijra. Should we, you know, try and basically encourage Muslims to leave and go back to Muslim lands? What would you make of that?
Well, I think Hijra is a very tempting option for many people. It is, of course, not just in France where people are having this discussion now. Here in the UK, there are people who are worried about where the education system, for example, is going, where teachers seemingly are telling five-year-olds that they have the right to choose their own gender. And then when parents push back, especially Muslim parents, they get told that their kids are being referred to the Prevent policy, which is supposedly a policy to push back against extremism. So there are many people who are feeling like it's not tenable in the long term. It's a very tempting way to feel, but there are two things to notice. Firstly, which is that generally society is pushing back against these things, and so Muslims have to remain and be at the forefront of those conversations. The second thing is, you know, it's Hijra becomes wajib upon you when there's no other option to, you know, let's say express your religion, or it's just the pressure is just too much. I don't think we're there yet. And I think as well, as I mentioned before, it's important that people remain in places like France, in particular, as you know, as force multipliers, let's say, because like you mentioned, there are some who say that Macron is trying to implement the new French empire. And while we know it will fail miserably for a variety of reasons, it's still important that there are people here, and I say here as in France, who remain to oppose those policies as well, because at the end of the day, that is what the government there would want. They would want their Muslim population to leave. So sometimes purely out of not giving them the satisfaction, it might be necessary to stay, bear those hardships, homeschool, find other alternatives. I don't know what the policies are in private schools there, but
they've actually banned homeschooling in France, as far as I know. What, according to Idris's comments, even that might be an issue. So again, I want to push you on this, because say, for example, the next generation of Muslims in that country, they're being educated in a form of French Islam. I think that's a term used by the French authorities as well. They want a French version of Islam, which is different to the Islam that comes out of the Middle East, the proper Islam that we know and love. Are you not scared that by staying, your children, their grandchildren, may end up basically leaving Islam?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, if like I said, if you get to the point where you can't practice your religion, and by that I don't mean just simply praying five times a day, I mean actually understanding the principles of your religion, standing up for your own identity, then yeah, absolutely, then if it gets to that point, the option is to leave. However, you know, we just have to see at what point does it get there. Parents have a huge role to play, a huge responsibility to play at home. Undoubtedly, you know, in the UK, that we have a lot more freedom. We've managed to fight for rights. We've managed to, get certain protections in place. Of course, those need to continue to be fought for as well. But likewise here and in other communities, if it does get to the point where your Islam, the very basis and fabric of your faith is coming into question, then yeah, absolutely, Hijra is an option. The only thing I would point out is careful where you go for Hijra, because we sometimes romanticize the Muslim world. And as I mentioned earlier, there are places like Tunisia, there are other Muslim countries which can sometimes be just as hostile to the hijab and to Islam as well.
For sure. Sister, let me come back to you and bring you into the discussion once again. It seems to me that the way that Muslim women dress is like a focus point for Islamophobes. It's always been the case. Women who wear hijab, women who wear the niqab, women who wear the burkini, they're always the ones being targeted, whether it be in the media or by Islamophobes on the ground or even by policymakers in the French Parliament or anywhere else. Why is it, in your opinion, that Muslim women are the main target of hostility? What is it about the hijab, the abaya, the niqab that seems to strike fear into those who just hate Islam?
Well, I suppose that as Muslim women wearing the hijab, we are more visible to the society. We're speaking also about a gendered Islamophobia. So obviously, women are also more vulnerable and children are more vulnerable. And we see that we're attacking those women in school, and this is where they actually first encountered discrimination, while it's supposed to be a safe space. And actually, in a report in 2022 about Islamophobic acts, there is more than 20% that took place in school where people are more vulnerable, and 15% of it were about clothing choices for the students. So they're trying to policy our bodies and what we should wear, what we should not wear, and basically not being able to be modest, even though we're living in France, which is the country of human rights, supposedly, where we should be able to express our religion through the laicity, but they are weaponizing this and instrumentalizing it against Muslim community and Muslim women.
Issa, we've got about a minute and a half left of the show, so I might end on you with this particular point, which I think needs raising. France is the type of country which I think sits on a high self-righteous pedestal, at least it puts itself there. And it would look at countries like Afghanistan, which is now headed by the Taliban, and they would point the finger of criticism at them and say, look how they treat women, look at them forcing the hijab laws onto their women, that's oppressive. They're forcing women to do something which maybe they don't want to do. But they are doing exactly the same thing, yet they claim to be an example of a secular democracy, which women have greater rights here than the Muslim world. So it seems to me as if the French authorities, particularly the President Emmanuel Macron, is a barefaced hypocrite. Tell me if I'm wrong. And also I think things like I've seen he's outraged at examples of activists criticizing him personally or trying to desecrate, say, for example, the French flag, symbols which they admire. But then when it comes to disrespecting our beloved prophet or the Quran, they seem to be all for that. So what do you make of that? Would you say that the French authorities have a problem with hypocrisy?
Well, firstly, Macron is a very thin-skinned individual as a human being as well. And yeah, I think it's we have to be careful not to make that direct comparison with Afghanistan, because, you know, there is that key question of hypocrisy. In France, there's a certain level of hypocrisy, because while they claim that, this applies to everyone, we actually know it's targeted at Muslims. And also their whole slogan is, egalitarianism and freedom and liberty and all of this kind of all these slogans, but they don't actually stick to it. So that's the key thing, which is that France doesn't practice what it preaches, whereas on the other hand, at least if you want to say, for example, take the example of the Taliban, they practice what they preach. Whether you like it or not is a different question.
Yes.
So I think on that point of hypocrisy, it is key. And again, yeah, you know, there are people that are in prison for example, questioning aspects of the Holocaust. Now, whether you agree with them or not, you can't on the one hand say you have the freedom of speech to burn the Quran or insult the Prophet Muhammad, and on the other hand, throw people in jail because they question certain parts of history. So again, it just goes to the deep-rooted hypocrisy and the deep-rooted anti-Islam sentiment in the French state that goes before the revolution all the way back to the Crusade period.
Thank you, Issa. Unfortunately, I'll have to jump in because we have approached the end of the show. And thank you to Sister Ibtihel for speaking to us from Paris. And thank you at home for everyone. Well, tune in again next week for another edition of Arn Islam. But for now, it's Salaamu Alaikum.